Okay, good. So yeah, as you know, the theme of the retreat was a talk that Bhante Sangharakshita, the founder of the movement, gave quite some time ago called Breaking Through to Buddhahood. And in that talk, he highlighted four areas where we could look at our sort of awareness or our knowledge of these areas and try to see through to something a bit higher, something a different sort of form of consciousness. So in this morning session, I'm just going to talk about two of those. So I'm going to talk about breaking through mechanical time and breaking through rational thinking. So the other two will be covered at various points during the retreat. But yeah, I'm just going to talk about these two this morning. And firstly, it's quite interesting talking about time because like for many years I've been a scientist, so I'm very interested in I've always been interested in science. Time and physics and the brain and psychology and all of that. So it's an area that I very much like to talk about. And Sangharakshita once said that he places a lot of emphasis on the arts, and the arts as a way, appreciation of the arts as a way of getting to a sort of higher level of consciousness. But he also said once that he believed that science was equally as valid as the arts. And if he had any faults, it was that he didn't know enough about science to be able to talk into the area. And he felt like it was a big failing of his. So thankfully, there's a few scientists in the order now. So yeah, well, I'm going to talk a little bit more into that, into the area, and we'll see what comes out. Okay, so first of all, let's talk about time. Time is actually really weird. Yeah, it's just really, really weird. What we're used to having these little clocks everywhere that tell us a certain set of numbers, and we live our whole lives by these numbers, like who we're meeting, when we need to be work at whatever time, or we spend an hour doing this, half an hour doing that, half an hour meditating, whatever. But it's, and we think of it as objective, we think of it as sort of existing outside of ourselves, that it's somehow there's this great big universal clock which is just ticking away and we have to live our lives by it. But if you start to sort of examine time, you realize it's actually very flexible. It varies substantially. And more than that, it's actually really subjective. Time is a really, really subjective experience. And the Buddha talked about his consciousness being beyond time. He talks about achieving the deathless state, so a state which is sort of outside of time. So how can this be? We think of time as just that, it's so ingrained into our lives that we don't even look at it, do we? We just sort of get on with it. But you can even see in your own experience indicators that time isn't quite what you think it is. I mean, just think about when you're very bored, so someone's giving a very boring Dharma talk, time seems to drag on, doesn't it? Or, that last hour before you go home from work, that hour seems like the longest hour of the day. So it can really be variable. And you see lots of things in our language about this, don't you? So that, there's a little saying like the watch pot never boils. And like the water doesn't take any more time to boil, it's just that your experience of it takes much longer. Yeah. And if I don't know, like if any of you have ever had sort of experimented with drugs in your younger days or even now, you like one of the things which that's associated with is time perception changing, isn't it? So, if you take ecstasy, for instance, a whole night can go through really quickly, can't it? Or if you on an acid trip, somehow like 10 minutes can seem like days. So it's kind of like, no, it's what I'm trying to get at here is it's all time is a product of our experience. It's quite flexible based upon that. And if you, oh yeah, there's also a really interesting psychological sort of paradigm, which is where if you, when you orientate to something, so say for instance, you move your eyes from one thing to another thing, That moment when you move your eyes, the initial moment of that takes longer, is expanded. So your brain extends that moment to give you time to orientate to the new thing that you're looking at. So the most obvious example of this is where you look at a clock. So if you ever had that experience where you look at a clock and that for the moment that second hand doesn't seem to move, you know, sometimes it can just seem to hang forever, and then it's the, sort of seems as though the clock can start again. And that's because when your brain orientates, when you have these the quick eye movements are called saccades, and so when you make one of these saccades to the clock, your brain actually extends the time to give you more time to process the new visual field, and then time resumes as normal. So see if you notice that anywhere. Yeah, it's if you're looking out for it, you can notice it. And then if we move out beyond ourselves a bit more and think about the universal perspective, time gets even weirder. Yeah, even weirder. So we talk about general relativity talks about space-time. So we're used to the three dimensions of space. Yep. So that way, that way, that way. And time is considered the fourth dimension. So it's actually completely ingrained in the structure and fabric of the universe. Yeah, so it's not sort of separate to that. So to move through space is to move through time. And you can do, so space can be curved. So when you have a big thing like a planet or a star, because it's really, really heavy, it bends gravity. It bends sort of, well, gravity is sort of like a bending in space, yeah? So it acts like a bit, so it's as if you've got a big sheet and you've put a bowling ball in the middle of the sheet. It will bend it down. And that's sort of how space is bent. But interestingly, that also bends time. So when you have something like really, really heavy, so you've all heard of black holes. So basically what they are is there's something that's so heavy that if you imagine it's like you've got your sheet and your big bowling ball, it's so heavy it's torn the sheet and it's pulled it right down. And what this means is that time actually stops at that point. So there's a tear in time as well as space. And if you try and get your head around that, that's really peculiar. And this may sound just like far-fetched theories, but of course, scientists love to test this sort of thing. So it's been tested. And one of the things that this theory says is the faster you go, the slower time gets. Yeah. So if you go really fast, time will go slower. So what people have done in the 50s is they took a very, very accurate atomic clock. So you can have these clocks which are really, really accurate. They're based on the how fast a cesium atom spins, which is like very fast. So they're really, really accurate. So you take these two clocks and then you sync them up exactly the right time. And you take one clock and you fire it up into space and you make it orbit the planet. And so it's going very fast. And then you leave the other clock on the ground. And then you check to see what time it is. And the one that which is going faster, round and round the Earth, actually shows time goes slower for that. So that clock shows less time than the one that stayed on the ground. Yeah. So there's, even at that speed, there's a difference. Yeah. So even like on a very, very small scale, getting on an aeroplane or getting in a car, your time will go ever so slightly slower than if you're not moving. Yeah. Isn't that weird? Really, really weird. Yeah. Now, if you take, what's interesting is that if you were actually able to ever travel at the speed of light, theory says that time would stop. Yeah. So if you happen to be a light photon, so a photon of light that's come out of the sun and flown across space and landed on Earth. So for that photon, if you could ever experience what it would be like for that photon, time wouldn't exist. Everything would happen at once. Yeah. So in some ways, that photon is sort of everywhere all at once, if you see what I mean.
Could you say that again?
Yeah. So for something travelling at the speed of light, that whole journey, so time would stop. And so that journey as it made wouldn't happen, yeah? It wouldn't have a start, it wouldn't have an end. It would just be everywhere all at once. Yeah, so that, because time doesn't exist for it.
But don't you have, sorry, I'm
being... Yeah. No, no.
Sorry, I know you're giving me talk. Don't you have things, things are measured in the speed of light, so light years?
Yeah.
In terms of distances.
Well, that's because it's subjective. You're absolutely correct. There is such a thing as light years. So the number of, the distance a photon will travel in a year.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
But that is...
That's different than the...
No, it's the same thing, but because that's our experience of it. So, you know, we do experience time, our being. And so it, to our experience, that photon does travel, if you see what I mean. Mm-hmm. But for that photon, it might travel for 100 million years, yeah, until it finally hits something and stops travelling. But for that photon, that 100 million years doesn't exist. It just is, it is in all of those places at once, if you see what I mean, yeah? And the theory goes that if, so supposedly you're not able to travel faster than light, but if you were to travel faster than light, and this theory of general relativity holds, then actually you would be travelling back in time. Time would flow backwards, yeah? And this is, this isn't just some sort of fanciful idea. This is our best theory about the nature of our universe, yeah? So what we think of as time is actually a really peculiar phenomenon, and we don't really know very much about it. Like, we have our subjective experience of it, and we govern our lives by it, but actually it's really quite strange, yeah? And we don't sort of pause to think about that very much, yeah? So I sort of let that settle in a little bit. And what we, what we call time is really, for us, a synchronous event. So, you know, so at 10:45, all of us came in here for this talk, and all of us had this synchronous event happen at the same time. But it's quite likely that some of our experiences are going quicker or slower, depending on how interesting you're finding my talk. And the interesting thing is that if you look at different perspectives, it seems very different. So, you know, if we, I don't know if you saw the sort of stars twinkling last night, you know, like very, very beautiful. And so we're sitting here, and so, you know, maybe we hear the bell go, and for us that's happening straight away, you know, and at the same time we're looking at the stars twinkling, and that's happening for us at the same time, you know. But for the star, that sort of light leaving the star, that twinkling, probably happened, you know, like a million years ago. And so for that star, that light and that bell going off for us is a million years apart. But for us, it's at the same time, if you see what I mean. So time is completely dependent on who's perceiving it and where. And every one of us, every perceived thing, has a different experience of it. Yeah, so it's completely subjective. So, what does this mean? Well, you know, Bante was trying to encourage us to think outside of our usual perceptions. And, you know, to consider these broader perspectives can help us think a bit differently about our time. You know, we do, our lives, as I said, are highly governed by time. And you often have things like, you know, so often someone will say, oh, I don't have the time to do this, don't have time to meditate, don't have time to do this, don't have time to do that. The reality is that we just need to think about time in a slightly different way, you know, think a bit differently. And, you know, the Buddha didn't have such a fixed idea of time. Of course, you know, he was a man and he lived and he had a lifespan and he died, so he was sort of, his body was certainly linked with a sort of time. It was definitely in time, but he was saying that his consciousness wasn't, or at least some aspect of his consciousness wasn't. And if you think about his society that he lived in, you know, the society of ancient India wasn't so strict on time, because you never knew when people were going to sort of turn up, you know, or you know, you just generally roughly knew the day or the season when people would arrive. And so there's a real, I think even today in India, there's a culture of welcoming your guests whenever they turn up, even if they're unannounced. You know, partly I think because they didn't have such a fixed idea of time. And so if you read some of the stories of the Buddha, just responded to whatever was going on. You know, he never sort of met a wanderer and said, oh, no, sorry, I'm meeting somebody else in 45 minutes. I don't have time. Just need to, sorry, can't give you a teaching just now. You know, he was always just very responsive to whatever the situation is needed. And so for, the other thing I should just say is that he also, Sudipa was saying a bit about the Buddha getting enlightened under the Bodhi tree. And that he sat for, well, I think 7 days and said that he would not get up until he achieved enlightenment. But after that event, he actually stayed where he was achieved enlightenment and just appreciated the Bodhi tree. So he's said to stay there for about another 7 days. So what I take that to mean is he just sort of appreciated his experience. You know, he just sort of was aware that something significant has happened. And he didn't rush off to go tell people, or, you know, like, he discovered this great thing. And although he did go and teach eventually, he took time to really appreciate that experience and appreciate the tree that has sheltered him and his environment. So he gave it all time, if you saw what I mean. So, so if we are slaves to mechanical time, if we try to narrow our lives too much into little half-hour blocks or hour blocks, or even plan our lives too much, you know, like have you planned out what you're going to do in the break later on today already? Or are you a bit more flexible to see what happens, you know? If we're too much of a slave to that, it can really constrain our experience, you know? So if you have a very sort of deep meditation and the dinner bell goes, do you just get up out of that experience and go and have dinner? Or do you let that experience unfold a bit more, you know? Do you sort of stay with what's happening to you? And I think, you know, just on planning, it's such a... I sometimes think of planning as the sixth hindrance, you know, like it's a real... it's so easy to sit in our meditation or sit around and sort of just plan out our whole life or plan what we're going to do next, not actually experience the moment that we're having right now. I'm really guilty of that myself. I have to constantly remind myself. So I think this is another form of being constrained by time, mechanical time, trying to compartmentalize our life. See if you can, just for this retreat, see if you can avoid doing that a little bit. See if you can avoid planning and see if you can just sort of respond to what happens. You know, on the most part, you've got a program, so just do the program and don't worry about the rest of it too much. And see if you can sort of notice when you're really engaged with your experience. So I don't know about you, but sometimes when I do that, it has a real sense of timelessness about it. Like, particularly I notice it when it's outside, it's a bit cold at the moment to go on around in the garden. But sometimes if you're just sort of appreciating the trees or, you know, even the stars or the animals around, there's a sense of timelessness about it, isn't there? You could just sort of sit there for ages and just time seems to unfold. You know, I have a particular memory from my childhood being at school and lying on the grass and looking at the clouds go by. And just that moment seemed to last for eternity. You know, so just sort of be aware of moments where your experience seems to deepen and that it has a more of a timeless quality about it. Yeah. So I'm going to move on to rational thinking now. And so rational thinking is a bit more like the fixed ways that we think about ourselves. Basically, it's like our views. So over the course of our lives, we've all accumulated ideas about how the world works and how we are and how other people are. And we build up these sort of constructs, these ideas about the way things are. And you'll often see them reflected in people's lifestyles or, political leanings or choices about the certain views that we have. And views can either be very helpful or they can be unhelpful. Generally, views always limit to some degree because they're a sort of shorthand. They're a kind of like, our world is extremely complex. And so we create these constructs. In psychology, they're often called schemas, which allow us to operate in the world with less effort. And often they're very useful because they allow us to, yeah, just get by quite simply. But if they're not very accurate or not grounded in reality, they can be very limiting. They can restrict our behaviour. And so you can have these things, like particularly nowadays where there's a whole plutocracy of choice, it's possible for people to just associate with things which reinforce their own belief structure, their own views. And so there was a thing on Facebook recently, I think, about the election in the States. And, you know, like people couldn't understand why people were voting for Trump or vice versa. You know, like if people were right wing or left wing or whatever, you have, you know, you're really convinced that that view is right. And you just think everyone else, why would you vote for that guy? Or, you know, why would you vote this way? And some scientists ran an experiment where they gave Democrat and Republican voters each other's Facebook feeds for a week. They basically, your Facebook feed consists of all the stuff that you like that supports your own views. And anything that you don't like and you don't support, you just unfollow, don't you? Or you, I don't want to see this. So what you end up with is everything which just reinforces your own views. So if you give a Democrat a Republican's feed, there's all this stuff around, you know, immigrants and jobs and, you know, poverty and so on, and how we need to protect ourselves and all this. And if you give the Democrats the Liberals feed, you get all of their stuff about, you know, education and healthcare and so on. And you find that it does actually influence their behaviour slightly. You know, so it actually alters them. So we're now living in an age where we can completely manage the amount of information that we take in, like the things we associate with. And we may think that we're actually quite balanced, but the chances are we're probably not. You know, we surround ourselves with people which generally agree with us. We mostly have things around us that agree with us, and we mostly do things that agree with us. So the chances are that you're on a Buddhist retreat because your views and values are a certain way, you know, and most of us probably share quite similar values here. We're not probably, in terms of views, we're not a probably very diverse bunch. And that might be sort of fair enough, you know, everyone has sort of social groups and so on. But it's helpful to be aware of that. It's helpful to think that we do have quite sort of what we consider rational views, which actually aren't completely diverse. You know, don't take in the full range of ideas. And then we can also look at the sort of rational views in our society. So, you know, there's a very strong materialist view in our society, which, to a greater or lesser degree, you've probably all taken on. You know, there is a view that money buys happiness to some degree. And, you know, maybe we're a little bit more removed from that, but we're probably still influenced by it. And it's largely an unchallenged view on the whole. It sort of exists always there in the background, you know, in our society. And there are other societies which don't have that so strongly, but we're sort of, in some ways this is a bit like psychological conditioning, but you know, rationally we think that is logical, that makes sense. You know, oh, if I have a bit more money, I can have a bit more choice, don't have to work so much, go on holiday a bit more. Do you know what I mean? And that's sort of logical, isn't it? But you know, we don't sort of quite see beyond that. And you know, that's sort of quite surface stuff. But it gets a bit more substantial than that, doesn't it? I mean, you know, we're very much a scientific materialist society. So we sort of assume that only stuff with evidence can be real. So, you know, generally anything that's a bit sort of superstitious, a bit spiritual. I mean, someone was telling me over breakfast that there was a German book which says that all English people believe in ghosts, you know, and how could that possibly be real? And I mean, that's very funny, isn't it? But, you know, the reality is that we do discount anything that is a bit paranormal, don't we? Superstitious, paranormal, oh, ghosts, spirits, fairies, you know, sea creatures, all of these things, they're complete, they're sort of fanciful, aren't they? Even perhaps like bodhisattvas, and those sorts of things. Like, how much do we individually believe them because of our sort of scientific background? You know, we're encouraged to think in terms of evidence, aren't we? And that sort of thing. But the reality is there more to that? You know, is there more to that? I was reading a book by what's his name? Vardika, The Buddha on Wall Street. And he's talking a little bit in that book about environmentalism and how our sort of scientific materialist culture just talks in terms of profit and resources and how the world is there for our own use. But actually, those more traditional societies which had a certain relationship with the land and believed that there was, spirits and gods of the forest and, all these other creatures, invisible creatures around us, actually lived in more harmony with the environment and actually had more happiness and more social cohesion and so on than we do. So in some ways, well, what's the more rational view? You know, the view which discounts all of that and leaves us a bit depressed and materialist, or the one which suggests that there's more than we know out there, stuff that we can't explain, and actually lives in a more balanced existence. So that's sort of one example. And then you've got the question of death, haven't you? The big question, you know. So in some ways, we've all got a terminal illness, and the illness is life. You know, to be alive is to die. And the current sort of view, I mean, it's a big problem, isn't it? You know, it's a big problem. And we need to sort of, as Buddhists, we're here to sort of think about that, aren't we? We're here to sort of face up to that reality. But it's very interesting to think about, so often I meet people that are interested in Buddhism, but they want to talk about rebirth because they can't quite get on board with it. They can't quite get on board with rebirth. Because the norm in society is to think that when you die, when your brain activity ceases and your cells die, that's it. It's just sort of a big black void and there's no consciousness, there's no awareness. And, that's the sort of accepted view, it seems, in our culture at the moment. But what people forget to mention is that that's also just a belief. There's no evidence that that's real as well. You know, that's just based upon a sort of rational assumption. Just because the body seems to, just because the cells die and the body seems to stop, it assumes that consciousness sort of ceases, as it were. And, you know, that's fine as a belief, isn't it? But it is just a belief. You know, whereas Buddhism throughout the ages would have a belief that something continues on. You know, it doesn't have a belief in reincarnation, that you're suddenly reborn in a new body with your same consciousness. It wouldn't say that. It would say that something continues. All the actions and all of the karma that you've built up in your life continues to some degree. I'm relatively agnostic about what that means, but I just want to place it on the same level as the belief that everything stops. If you see what I mean? That everything is just blackness. They're beliefs. The reality is we don't really know what happens, do we? You know, none of us have any evidence to know what happens after that. So by being aware of what influences us, by the views that we hold about things, we can just try and look beyond that more rational thinking, particularly rational thinking that we've taken on from other places. What I would say to us is, like, you don't have to accept the irrational, but be open to it. Yeah, be open to it. And I had a really interesting insight when I was on my ordination course and was being ordained. I had an issue with a friend of mine, actually, a friend of mine I have quite a lot of respect for. But I was, during the course of this retreat, I realised I was really sort of angry at him for something. And it took me ages to work out that my grievance was basically that I didn't feel like he saw me properly, that that I was somehow more than he saw me, and that's why I felt a bit aggrieved by it. And then as the retreat went on, I suddenly realized that why do I know that who I am, as it were? Like, I have an idea about myself, about who I am, and I think I know who I am, really, and that I have the best sort of perspective. But the reality is my friend's sort of observation of me, my friend's experience of me is just as valid. Like, his experience of me is valid, you know, and I can't not agree with that because he's having an experience. And so what I realised is that even I don't know who I am, you know, like with him, I must be a certain way. I must have done certain things which have given him a certain view of myself. And just because I don't think of myself as that way doesn't mean that I'm not that way, as it were. So what I started to think is that, oh yes, the sort of identity, our identity, who we think we are, is actually just this big sort of conglomeration of all of the interactions we have. And that even ourselves, we don't really know all of the influences and impacts that we have, as it were. As people follow, yeah? Mm-hmm. So I started thinking, oh, like, I, you know, the rational view is that, oh, I know who I am because I see everything I do. But I don't think that's true. I don't think that's true. And what we talk in our community, we have a principle of having friends, spiritual friends. We often call them Kalyana Mitras. So they're people who know you very well and in some ways there to support our own spiritual practice. And often we'll meet up in groups. I know many of you are in Mitra groups, but you can also, if you ask for ordination, you meet up in groups which talk about your progress and your development. And the reason that they're there is that their friends can really help reflect back who you are. So, you know, we all have blind spots about ourselves and in our thinking about ourselves. And so friends are really, really good to reflect who we actually are, yeah? And it can give us insights into that. Okay, and then just finally, a bit related to that identity is, you know, this rational idea of ours that we are a being, that we are an individual being, yeah? All of our experience seems to tell us that we're separate, aren't we? You know, we have this skin and we're here and this is me and that's all you. And I'm definitely separate from you. Everything seems to say that. But if you sort of let into the slightly more, yeah, if you let in the more irrational ideas, then, and you start to look at where that me is, it's not so clear, it's not so evident. You know, even, just taking a scientific perspective again, so most of our bodies, actually we've got, you know, 3 times as many bacterial cells in our bodies than we do our own cells, yeah? So we're mostly bacteria, yeah? And these bacteria live inside us, live in our stomachs predominantly, and they help us digest our food, yeah? They release all sorts of nutrients and so on, and actually we couldn't live without them, you know? It's thought that things like IBS and Crohn's disease and so on, possibly celiac disease, that sort of thing, are actually some result of some imbalance in that bacterial colony that we carry around with us. Yeah, so we're more of a symbiotic being. You know, we exist in harmony with our colony of bacteria that we carry around. And everybody's colony is a bit different. Yeah, it's like a fingerprint. Yeah, so we think of ourselves as one thing. Well, we're not one thing. We're a multitude of organisms all walking around together. And we're constantly sort of, our cells are constantly regenerating as well. So, you know, every tissue in our body regenerates at a slightly different rate. But roughly it's thought that every 7 years or so, our cells will replace themselves. So think about that. So there's a possibility that none of the cells in your body are more than 7 years old. But I bet you think of yourself as more than 7 years old. So, who are you? Are you that body? The body's sort of new, as it were, but your consciousness is older, and you know, what's the relationship between that? Yeah. So where is you? And think about the sort of constant flow. So again, we think of an inside and an outside, but You know, the food that we eat, the breakfast that you had this morning, is now being made into your cells. You know, it's entering your cells and being used as part of your body. And other things being excreted. And we drink water. Water flows in, water flows out. And then more moment by moment, you've got the breath. You know, you've got the constant influx of oxygen, which is metabolized with sugars and then gets excreted as carbon dioxide. So, you know, there's a constant inflow from the outside and a constant outflow from the inside, you know. We are a sort of, we're a constant process unfolding. We're not a sort of fixed single thing. But it seems like that, doesn't it? It seems like that. For all intents and purposes, our rational mind tells us we're an I, tells us we're an it, tells us that you're a you and I'm a me, and that we're not separate. But actually, everything is just sort of flowing in and flowing out all the time. So there is a... Oh, yes. Oh, the best one. No, I really like this one. Sorry, I just have to get something. So we know quite a lot about the structure of elements and atoms and so on now. So we all know what an atom is, yeah? So it's a... all of these molecules and so on are made up of atoms, which consist of a nucleus and some electrons. So the nucleus is like this tiny, tiny, small thing. And then these electrons sort of exist around it. Yeah. And these things make up the structure of everything around us. But what's really interesting is that actually 99% of an atom is actually empty space. So this nucleus is tiny. And, you know, these electrons just exist around it. So in terms of the solar system, if the sun was the nucleus, the edge of the sort of atom would be where sort of Jupiter is. Yeah, so it's like, you know, really vast. So it's mainly empty. Yeah. So if you think about that, that means that we're basically 99% nothing. Yeah, so we're me and you and this floor and this shrine and this room pretty much exists mostly as empty space. Yeah, we're sort of condensations of energy, yeah, just like the little ripples, and the rest is just complete space. Yeah, we're essentially like ephemeral beings, almost like ghosts. And yet our experience is that it's all solid. Yeah, it's all solid. Because we can reach out and touch it, and that's our experience. But actually, if you look deeper into even what science says, and it says, no, 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 it's not like that at all. Actually, it's all empty. It's all empty. Well, you know, there's a little bit of stuff. Tiny, tiny little bit of stuff. So yeah, so just, so again, I wanted to just draw your perspective out a bit and try and make you think in a little bit of a different way about what you think you is, you know, what you think this being is, what you think this body is. And there's actually a practice that you can do about this called the six element practice, which is done in our movement. I'm not going to take you through that, but I did think I'd just take you through a few little reflections related to that, a similar sort of thing. So just see if you could get a bit of an experience of this flow, this process going on. Yeah. So if you set yourself up for a sort of a meditation, it's just going to be sort of, you know, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, not very long at all. But we'll just try and get a little flavour of that. Try and get a little sense of that.